All right. When we started last Thursday, we started with perioperative nursing, and we talked a lot about preoperative nursing, and then we got into some intraoperative, the beginning of the intraoperative kind of time. But not a whole lot into that, only as much that got into, come on, it's like walking a dog. I guess I could put this on. No, I don't want to put that on yet. Not quite ready for that yet. Before we go on to what we're going to do today, I want to talk about what we did the other day, okay? It's always good to review a little bit and summarize sort of what we've done. I gave you a big word, perioperative nursing, which covers those three categories, right? Pre, during, or intra, and post. Talked about classifying surgical procedures in a couple of different ways, whether or not they were major or minor, whether or not they were elective or urgent. And then talked about those four things that underlie almost all operative reasons, the reason for doing this, what necessitates surgery. And those four words were obstruction, erosion, perforation, and tumors. There are unusual and different and additional things, but those are the major ones. And then the list of vocabulary words for the types of surgery that you'll read more in textbooks than you will really read in the clinical area. But you will occasionally come across some of those words. The funny one was the ablative.
I just have a question on that. In the readings, it had curative and ablative. Are they pretty much related in the same way?
Well, they can be. Okay. They can be. There's always a little merging on some things, and this is one of those areas. The thing to remember about ablative is what? It's a hysterectomy. It's an appendectomy. And when you see ectomy, what that means is taken out, removed. Okay? A diseased organ taken out. We talked a bit about preoperative anxiety and how that's a fairly normal kind of thing. And preoperative assessment. And factors that increase surgical risk. And that list is familiar to a lot of you, certainly age continuums at the either end, poor nutrition, obesity, anybody who's been treated with radiation therapy, imbalances of fluid and electrolytes, extreme anxieties and fears, okay. Common preoperative kinds of tests, and I went into those just a little bit, but mentioned the CBC in your analysis. Not new tests to you, but these are common on pre-op. A pre-op checklist, whether it's a little strip of paper, whether it's a whole sheet of paper, whether it's generated by the computer, depending on the system you're working in, will have all of these kinds of things in. All of these things that need to be attended to and checked off. Have they been done beforehand? Informed consent, which is a review of what you had last semester, must be done before the patient is sedated, or it's not considered valid. This is one of those liability issue kinds of things, so you need to be careful and be sure about that. Nurses don't do that, but they frequently witness it. Then we went on to preoperative teaching and areas to teach, and the areas to teach spanned the waterfront. Depends on the person's situation, where they're coming from. So whenever you're teaching anything, you always start with, what do they already know? What are they most interested in? What is the hot topic, by Ramadola's term, what's the hot topic for them right now in regard to this surgery? You may want to go into something like inspentive spirometry, which we'll talk about a little bit later. They're not there. They want to talk about where their family can wait. So find out where they're coming from before you go, because there are lots and lots of areas in which to teach. And then that had that big slide with teaching with all different topic areas, and I said I would deal with those areas as we got to those areas, because most of the teaching that's called or labeled preoperative teaching, has to do with postoperative behavior and what they're going to do during that time. But you do it preoperatively while they're hopefully an outpatient, if this is an elective plan kind of thing, on their feet, in their own clothes, driving to you, functioning in the world, standing there as a whole person, not depleted, on the bed, patient, armband on, in pain, scared to death, dealing with trauma or whatever had happened. Do you have to do it that way sometimes? Yeah. You can't do nearly as much. But if you can do it when they are more in control of their world, much better time. And if you get to them the idea that these things that they do for themselves prevent complications and enhance their faster healing, so it is in their best interest to do these things. That's the point you're trying to get across, because you want to engage them in their own health arena, in their own healing situation, so that they are their own best friend here. And they're not going to sabotage themselves. Okay? All right, so, and that's been shown to be very, very helpful. Day of surgery, all the last, lots of checking, just lots and lots of checking, making sure that all the things that have been done according to the system and the organization that you're working in, last-minute procedures, are all the orders ticked off, are all the tests done? Is there any missing part of anything? Now, the preoperative medication slide was a little, I think, outdated, because I limited it. I put on that sedatives, hypnotics, narcotics, tranquilizers, anticholinergics. And anticholinergics, by the way, is getting to be a dated term. That's more cholinergic blocking agents. That's what your books will say now, cholinergic blocking agents. But that's not all that can be used. On page 1210 of your fundamentals book, okay, which has a nice couple of chapters on the surgical client, let me read you just a couple sentences. Preoperative medications may be ordered by the anesthesiologist or surgeon, most often anesthesiologist, to do some of the following things: to reduce preoperative anxiety, tranquilizers kind of fits that bill, minimize secretions in the respiratory tract, the cholinergic blocking agents do that very well, to decrease acidity and production of gastric secretions. I didn't mention that one, and that one is something that is used fairly regularly to relieve pain, to decrease metabolism so that the less of the anesthetic agent is necessary, and I did mention that, okay? So if you want to look at that yourself, too. Are these chapters on the operative client from the fundamentals book on your reading list?
Yes.
They probably are, because that's where it is. Okay. And we talked about traveling to the OR, getting into the OR, positioning injury in your fundamentals text. In this chapter on the surgical client, spend careful time with the section in the chapters that has the appropriate nursing diagnosis, and look at the way they're worded. They're very good. They're very good, and they're very zeroed in for this kind of client. Okay? We talked about all the different kinds of position and anesthesia induction. Well, now we're about up to where we need to be, so let's look at some things about anesthesia. Well, here you have two general categories, one general and one regional. And, of course, let's start with the general. That's on the left there. It's the way the eye is used to reading things from left to right. It affects entire body and renders the person totally unconscious. Another way of looking at the term totally unconscious is this renders the patient very vulnerable. Because this loss of consciousness means that there is a lack of sensory perception and motor discharge at that nerve muscle connection. And there is a depression of all reflex responses in the body. And one reflex response of the body that comes to my mind is the cough reflex. Unconsciousness is produced by general anesthesia when the blood circulating to the brain contains an adequate amount of the anesthetic agent. Okay, regional anesthesia, and this is like an overview kind of thing, just looking at these two types, and then we're going to come back to them a little bit. Regional anesthesia is local anesthesia that depresses superficial nerves and blocks the conduction of pain impulses from a specific area or a specific region. So it's narrower, more specific. It is not practical for all types of procedures. There are individual responses to the drugs that are used for regional types of anesthesia, for locally used anesthetic drugs. There can be rapid absorption of the drug and cause a potential overuse or overdose situation. Or it may not be effective in some people. May not work. Certain kinds of dental procedures come to mind where Novocaines and so forth don't always work. It is, however, more economic. It uses more simplified kinds of equipment. And it is suitable for patients who have recently had the intake of food or fluids. Somebody, let's say, who's been in a motor vehicle accident and there's a need for surgery, and, there's McDonald's bags in the car. And they don't know when this person ate last, and they can't risk that. So that would be an example. General anesthesia. Just a little more detailed here. Basically, there are two methods of administering general anesthesia, inhalation and IV. The inhalation of gases or vaporous liquids for anesthetic purposes takes place through a mask and or an endotracheal tube. And I don't have the endotracheal tube yet, but she's going to bring it in to me. We're sharing that. I thought I had a picture of it, and I do have a picture of it on the next slide. And the endotracheal tube is this little guy. And the difference between these two is that this one comes down much further. You see, this is just an artificial airway. Different sizes of them, those are airways. Those are put in afterwards also, after the surgery. When this comes out frequently, just to hold the tongue out of place. But let's look at this tube. It's going in through which opening? Nasal or oral? Can you tell from that picture? It's going in orally. Orally, yeah. There are nasal ones, but they're harder to do. Smaller to handle, harder to do. Okay. Notice that it has a curve to it. Notice down here it has a balloon. A balloon. Just like the Foley catheter, where you get it in place and then you put the saline in it, okay? So that it occludes the entire trachea. So that what is going into the air and the level of oxygen and the level of anesthetic gases that's going into this person's trachea down into their lungs is totally controlled and not contaminated, if you will, by any other air that is coming through. And also, it blocks that area off that if there's any kind of gastric reflux or fluids in from the GI tract, they're not going to get down there. Because here's another thing that has made this person's body somewhat vulnerable. So these are protective things on it also. It allows them delivery of the gases in a more purified way of delivering and a safety protection here so that they've got a better control over it. So note the difference in the length of each tube. This one comes down much further. The airway, all it really does is it keeps the tongue from shifting back and occluding the airway. Why don't you pass these around? Just to look at the different sizes of them. You can open it if you want to. The endotracheal tube ensures an open trachea for the passage of gases. Because it goes down beyond the larynx and beyond the epiglottis. Beyond this area. Let's look a little more in depth at general anesthesia. The methods that are employed, the inhalation or the intravenous, again, a repeat. The inhalation is of gases or vaporous kinds of liquids. The intravenous infusion is of some type of liquid sterile anesthetic agent. And the bottom part of this slide talks about flexibility. Flexibility with what? Well, let me give you a couple of examples or points on that. General anesthesia can be used and modified, really, for any type of surgery. So that's what it means. That's one of the things it means. It can also be used for any patient despite his or her age or physical condition. That opens the door wide. So those are two examples of the flexibility. Adjunctive agents are usually also used by the anesthesiologist. Additional kinds of anesthetic type agents or drugs that are used along with the primary anesthetic agent. And these are neuromuscular blocking agents, and they're neuromuscular blocking agents that are used to relax muscles in abdominal and thoracic surgery. And relaxing the muscles, this means that they also facilitate the intubation that we just looked at, the endotracheal tube. And they're used to treat laryngospasm and assist in mechanical ventilation if that is needed. When these medications are used, the patient, these neuroblocking agents is what I'm talking about now, when these are used, the patient cannot move or breathe on their own. Did you get that? Did you hear that? I'm just teasing you a little bit. I just want you to make sure that you heard the gravity of that statement. These are deliberate agents that are used in order to relax these large muscles. And when they're relaxed, it interferes with the nerve-muscle connection, and this person can't move or breathe on their own. It is to make them, again, more amenable to whatever needs to be done. It puts in control who? The team that's doing their things. It takes away the control from this person's body. Yes?
Does the heart rate?
All these things affect the heart rate, and there's a dance that they do and keeping the levels as close to normal as they can. And they do. They do an amazing job at that. when these meds, I just said that, cannot move or breathe on their own, but they can still hear. And at times do, not regularly, do hear. It's not a top common kind of thing that they're going to hear everything that's going on. But some people really do. Just keep it in mind when you're in that arena. Okay, another thing that general anesthetics or general anesthesia does is that it can be used during long or lengthy procedures with a fair amount of comfort, maximum comfort for the patient. So it can be used for long procedures. The anesthesiologist can have better control over monitoring the vital signs and the status of this patient's well-being if it's an extremely anxious patient. To get them past that, they can monitor the physical status better. The anesthesiologist is often able to better control respiratory and circulatory functions when the patient is unconscious rather than when awake and fearful. Some disadvantages of, I don't have them on the list, but let's look at some disadvantages of general anesthesia. Respiratory and circulatory depression. Most anesthesia deaths result from such depressions of function. These are powerful agents. Another disadvantage, and this is getting to be less so in today's world, and that's explosion hazards. Explosions occur infrequently, but it is guarded against. The possibility is guarded against. That risk of possible explosion is the reason behind anything in the OR that is metallic or electrically connected needs to be safely grounded. And the preventions of any buildup of static electricity. So it's guarded against. Now, your book does a page on this, or half of a page, so also look at that, and it will be a good addendum to this. Whenever something is listed in this way, it makes it sound like it's very clear and very discreet and all on its own. And you're going to see it in that way. I'm here to tell you that it won't be that way. In general, when narcotics and neuromuscular relaxant drugs are given, some of the preoperative kinds of medications, several of these stages are muted or absent. You may not even see them, particularly in adult patients. So they're not going to be as crystal clear. And in fact, when students are observing in the ORs, they frequently don't want you to come in until the induction is complete. They don't want any distraction. And they will say to everybody in the room, quiet, until they get past particularly that beginning and what's called the excitement phase. Okay? So it's unlikely that you're really going to see this. Stage one, beginning. Not bad. When gas or IV drug, whatever is being used, starts, when it's started, it leads to a loss of consciousness, and the patient may appear drowsy, dizzy, almost inebriated looking. In the patient's body, there will be a feeling of warmth, detachment, a ringing or roaring in the ears, and surrounding noises are exaggerated. Now, if any of you have had anesthesia, this will come back to you as, yes, that is what I remember. Yes. The room should be kept quiet during this induction or beginning part, and the OR doors are closed. They really don't want other things going on. Stage two, excitement. The loss of consciousness leads into relaxation. However, this patient can appear to be excited, may breathe irregularly, may move arms, legs, and body. There can be struggling, shouting, talking, singing, laughing, crying. These responses can usually be avoided by judicious suggestion beforehand from the anesthesiologist, who is right there before this even starts, to help ensure a smooth and rapid induction. Now, this kind of excitement kind of thing is more likely, if it's going to happen, is more likely to happen in young children, adolescents, and young adults. When we get to be old stodgies, we forget the excitement. Okay? Persons in the OR at this time need to be quiet and alert and assist the anesthesiologist if needed. They will do all kinds of clever little things for children to get them, you know, very suggestible kinds of things, and toys and gloves that are blown up like balloons, and faces drawn on them, and talking about different things, and just kind of engage them, because the possibility of this happening is a little higher. But if they can lower their anxiety level, and remember, anxiety level at this time, pretty normal, right? Sure. Okay. Stage three, surgical anesthesia. Patient is unconscious and quiet. There are regular respirations. There is that loss of reflexes. There is general depression of the vital functions in the body. The pupils are small, but they contract to light. And this is something that you will see the anesthesiologist do regularly. Pick that light up there, lift the lid. Are they contracting? Eyelid reflexes disappear, the jaw is relaxed, auditory sensation is lost during this time. Skin and mucous membrane should be pink. If it's Caucasian skin, it may appear slightly flushed from the anesthesia. This stage, stage three, has several planes within it. And we're not going to go in those. That's not our intent. We don't need to do that. But several planes within it. And this stage can be maintained for hours if needed. And they move through those planes just a little bit, just to change those vital signs a bit. Four is where you don't want to go. Four is bad. This means possible respiratory failure, possible cardiac arrest, and possible death. So this is the danger stage. What's done for this is the anesthesia is stopped immediately, and stimulants and narcotic antagonists can be used. CPR can go on. I mean, all kinds of things can go on. Have you ever seen this? Good anesthesias. See, that whole area is...
You could not speak to him at all. He literally had a full-fledged panic. Like, had to be, like, mentally...
He must have had a really bad experience. That's what I'm guessing. This person had a really, really bad experience.
A lot of them didn't do children.
Children are very tricky in this excitement thing. Very, very tricky. In children, exactly. Focused, yeah. Responsibility is very, very high. Yes. Right. Right. I have a good friend who's a respiratory therapist of many, many years. And I just visited her over the break. She's moved down to Florida. And she's applied for a part-time job when the winter people come down, you know. She really is has sort of retired from her other place, but she likes working and stuff. And she said, what they need and what I have to offer are two different things. What they really need is somebody in their NICU, in their intensive care for newborns. And she said, I won't do that. She said, I have had one really negative experience with that. But she said, Joyce, that airway is so tiny. And so we're talking newborns here. And she said, that airway is so tiny. And getting that airway in place and seeing, she said, I just don't have the confidence level. And this is somebody with almost 25 years of experience, clinical experience, all the time, working with all kinds of people. But she didn't want to deal with this at all. And she said, I would understand if they hired somebody else because that is what they need. I can't provide that and I'm not going to do it. I mean, I'm not going to get myself there. If she hasn't done it in these 25 years, she's not going to do it now. So it is a much more specialized thing. And I think a great deal of it is just the size of the parts.
You really think it's that and it's not like
this? And just being able to visualize and get it in. And then for anesthesia, that whole excitement and everything. And the risk is high. I mean, we're talking about people becoming vulnerable to these agents. Now if we've got a 2-year-old child who is vulnerable in the world because they are a dependent 2-year-old child and they've got parents and family and all, I mean, there's a lot riding on this. So it's just a huge, huge thing. I think there's a reality based to the fear. So anyway, danger is where you don't want to go. I think it's appropriately named. And, of course, stage 3 is what you need to remember, right? Stage 3 is where it can go for a long time because that's where they do the surgery. All right, we're going to move away from general anesthesia and look at regional anesthesia. And, of course, the purpose is kind of self-evident. It's to be able to do something painful to somebody and they won't feel it. to reduce all painful sensation in a region, but without the unconsciousness. So only one region of the body is being anesthetized. The agent is deposited on a nerve or a nerve pathway and thus blocks the transmission of the painful stimuli up to the brain. Advantages: better airway control, fewer respiratory complications, sure. Other advantages to this: uses more simplified equipment, it is more economic. It avoids some of the undesirable effects of general anesthesia, such as the grogginess that can follow the depressed respirations, higher risk level. It's suitable for patients who've had food and fluids. I've said this before. So it's common in unplanned surgeries. It's also non-flammable. So there are a lot of advantages to this. Now, there are some disadvantages too. Anxiety and fear are not allayed with regional anesthesia alone. So other IV drugs are used so that the patient is not aware of what's going on. So it is regional anesthesia for the area of the body that's being dealt with, but they slip other little things, you know those ports on the IV tubing. And anesthesiologists use those all the time. And they've got their medicines, their syringes all lined up. They are highly, highly organized. A very compulsive, obsessive compulsive, and I would want that in somebody who's right there. It's a very intense kind of job that they have. and they have things lined up and labeled. And have you seen this? You've seen how they do it. I mean, they're very, their workstation is really immaculate. I mean, there is no room for error here. So they really are very good at that. And so, yes, this is numbed, and you can hit on it and cut on it and do all kinds of things, and you don't feel it, but that's not quite enough. So they, the little tranquilizers and other things, so you really don't hear what's going on. Another disadvantage of it is that there's a lack of flexibility. This is difficult to use with small children and difficult to use with elderly, senile persons, or anybody who's uncooperative. And another disadvantage is it has a short time period. So it can't be used for lengthy operations. So there are pluses and minuses. Some examples. And before I go into some of these examples, the major differences between the various types of regional anesthesia are the rate or the time that the anesthetic agent diffuses from the site of its injection or application. Because it might be a spray-on topical kind of thing on mucous membranes, which can be a form of regional anesthesia to that area. So the major differences are going to vary with the rate of the time, how long it takes to get from where it's put on or in, and the size of the region to be anesthetized. So topical anesthesia. A good example is a spray that's used on throats for bronchoscopy or any kind of gastrostomy testing done. Spray on throats, or a cream, EMLA cream, E-M-L-A, that's an acronym, stands for something, don't ask me what. Capital letters, EMLA, and it's just referred to as EMLA, is a cream, actually, that they will use in, it's a topical to put on, and they use it mostly for pediatric kinds of things, if an IV in. They put it on and cover it with like saran wrap or something. I'm thinking of babies and different things for IVs. But it has to go, the disadvantage is it has to go on a good 45 minutes ahead of time for it to really work. But if this is a child who's dealing with a lot of sticks, this is well worth it. And the pediatrician can order it. And they can have it at their home, and they can put it on and you know, be all ready if they're coming for outpatient procedures or something. Do it themselves, and then the stick can be done. And it definitely does take away a little bit of that pinch feeling. Now, if you're dealing with a child, say, who has leukemia, and blood sticking is just an ongoing thing, this is a very helpful kind of thing. Both of these, any kind of topical thing is going to have a fairly short period of effectiveness. So short time of usefulness would be another way to put it. A local block, it's a fairly defined small area that can be rendered without sensation, used for many different types of repairs in the emergency departments, suturing, cuts, punches, small injuries, very, very common. Spinal anesthesia, and we'll have some pictures in just a minute. In spinal anesthesia, the anesthetic agent is introduced into the subarachnoid space at lumbar level L4 and L5, and this produces anesthesia of the lower extremities, the perineum, and the lower abdomen. Sideline position of the patient is usually what's used for insertion, and then the patient is immediately placed on their back. It's relatively inexpensive, and it has a pretty good safety record. It doesn't cloud the patient's consciousness or alertness. Again, just like I think I mentioned before, other drugs are usually given intravenously so that the person can sleep, so the operation. The biggest complication of spinal anesthesia is hypotension, drop in blood pressure. Because the anesthetic effect on the sympathetic nerves causes the blood pressure to drop. And so the blood pressure needs to be monitored very carefully for someone who has a spinal. A side effect of spinal anesthesia is the post-procedure headache. This is caused by a loss of cerebral spinal fluid, which is abbreviated with an acronym of capital letters CSF, cerebral spinal fluid, and you will see that acronym in charts and different things, so it would do you well to kind of get familiar with that one. Caused by a loss of this from the subarachnoid space, resulting in a kind of traction of the meninges around the brain on the pressure-sensitive intracranial area, okay? It just took a little bit of the padding out, if you want to think about that, a little bit of extra fluid, because when they put the needle in, some of that fluid leaks out. And in some people, their bodies are sensitive to that, and they get that headache. Treatment, if this is the situation, treatment includes keeping the patient flat in bed to relieve the meningeal linings of the brain, irritation, and encouraging an increased fluid intake to increase the intravascular volume and increase the production and volume, eventually, of cerebral spinal fluid, and giving analgesics to deal with the pain. In my experience, when people have these, you can do all those things, and it seems to take about 2 weeks for it to go away. They're fine as long as they're laying flat. But they get up and they've got a headache, and it's just a real pain. And it can't really predict when that's going to happen. Yeah. Have you had one?
My husband's had
one. Okay. Yeah. Was he okay when he was laying flat?
Yeah, when he was laying flat. But
it's hard to live your life when you're laying flat, though.
Like that especially for
all your other muscles start to come into play, right? How would he describe it?
It's a severe migraine. It's I don't know. Does anybody get sinus headaches?
Yeah.
You ever get that pressure?
Yeah.
That's it's just screaming. Like screaming. He would scream. Like it's like excruciating. And it took, I'd say, almost 2 to 3 weeks for it to. Yeah. And it happens fast, too. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It does. So it's one of the things that has to be put into the cup that you're dealing with in making these choices.
Which I've seen in hospital, you know, where I work, we've had people that just had spinals, regular spinals to get fluid for testing.
Mm-hmm.
And they get them, and they only keep them on bed rest for probably, it used to be like a 10 to 12 hour period.
I know.
They've lessened it to probably about 6 to 8 hours.
Because they want the bed for something else.
Yeah, which I could argue then.
Yeah.
I beg to differ. But
yes.
But it's not fun. It's not a fun experience.
No, it is not. It is not.
So if you were to donate spinal fluid, the side effects could possibly
go to the same area.
Yeah, the same thing, right?
Area.
If you were to, I'm sorry, what? Do you donate spinal fluid?
Yes, bone marrow.
You're talking bone marrow.
Spinal fluid for some,
I have never heard of spinal fluid. Mm-mm. Bone marrow, yes. Yes.
And they go into the same area for that?
What, bone marrow?
Mm-hmm.
No. No. Okay. This is spinal anesthesia, and this is epidural anesthesia. And they're showing it actually between 3 and 4 rather than 4 and 5. Okay. The differences are very difficult to see. In an epidural, which is another form of regional anesthesia, the local anesthetic agent is injected into the epidural space, which is located outside the dura mater of the spinal cord. And there's no direct contact with the spinal cord or with nerve roots. However, with an epidural, because it's sort of outside a certain layer, a much larger dose of the agent is needed because it doesn't have this direct contact with the nerve roots. And you can see the fluid dripping out. It's used frequently for surgeries involving the abdomen and lower extremities. The advantages of epidural are that there's a reduced rate of headaches, spinal headache, because it doesn't go quite as far, and a reduced rate of the hypotensive reactions or the drop in blood pressure. There are some good pictures in this from your fundamentals text, so be sure to look in that. Okay, let's do a little intraoperative summary here. Safety is the thing you circle. Patient safety is the big thing because they have been rendered vulnerable. And trying to keep their body's parameters homeostatic, trying to maintain homeostasis, okay, of all the vital signs. And fluids and electrolytes and everything. Various NANDA nursing diagnoses that might be appropriate for the intraoperative client include such things as risk for aspiration, altered protection. These are also in your book in that part that I told you on the pages where they have nursing diagnosis, impaired skin integrity, risk for perioperative positioning injury, risk for altered body temperature, altered tissue perfusion, risk for fluid volume deficit. The overall goals of care in the intraoperative period are to maintain this person's safety and homeostasis. So some of these things that I've listed are risk for and other things are obviously real. There is now, even if it's one of the newer minimally invasive surgeries, there is impaired skin integrity. And there is altered tissue integrity. And with anesthesia, there is risk for aspiration. And there is altered protection. So they all fit. Immediate post-anesthetic phase. This is right after the OR. The wound has been covered, whatever it is. Surgical asepsis has now broken down. We've moved to just clean technique or medical asepsis. Positioning wedges and pillows are taken out. Anesthesiologist has brought the patient back to a level and is getting certain responses. And it's safe now to, and stay, this patient is stable enough now to move them to the immediate place that used to be called the recovery room where they recovered, and now it's called PACU, and that's the acronym that stands for Post-Anesthesia Care Unit. Is that it? Okay. Okay. And so this is what we're talking about, this PACU time. Okay. And usually a nurse and the anesthetist goes in with the patient. If the anesthetist can't go right then, they will go in afterwards. But that PACU nurse wants to see the anesthetic rector, needs to know certain things. The PACU nurse needs to get a report about the surgery. That includes, of course, what type it was, how long it lasted, the type of anesthesia that was used, if there were any complications of anesthesia, what the approximate fluid and blood loss was, and was there any replacement that was done, and were there any complications. The nurse then, after getting this report, does an assessment, which includes, and let's look at airway first, and I've already passed this around, okay, adequacy, this is an emergency oral airway. What is the adequacy of this individual's, this patient's airway? Is it open? They will suction if it's needed. This artificial airway is maintained in place generally until the client spits it out or until coughing returns. In other words, the endotracheal tube that was down, if they were getting general anesthesia, is taken out and an artificial airway is put in. This is done by the anesthesiologist. Now, when it's done, there's got to be a little latitude on that. If this person needs to be connected to a ventilator, it's going to be connected to a ventilator with this endotracheal tube still in place, obviously. But let's say it's not that kind of situation, and it's more common, and that comes out, and the airway is put in, and that is maintained in place to keep the tongue from falling back and blocking the throat, blocking the larynx and the trachea, until the client spits it out or until coughing returns. Endotracheal tubes are not removed until the person is awake and able to maintain their own airway. So this, you know, I realize I'm giving you a couple of different things that sort of counteract one another. It's a matter of the assessment. What does the assessment of this patient's respiratory airway status tell us? What needs to be done here? They're positioned on their side a little bit with the face slightly down, no pillow. Everything, these are things to protect airway, which I'm still talking about. In this position, gravity helps to keep the tongue forward, preventing occlusion of the pharynx and allowing drainage of the mucus or vomitus out of the mouth rather than down the respiratory tree. Now, this positioning thing that I'm talking about is particularly applicable if they've coughed out their airway, right? When they no longer have that in there to hold the tongue in place, and you really want to make sure that they're positioned well. Oxygen saturation, the little clothespin pinch, and what are the percentages? What's the adequacy of ventilation, the in and out of air in the lungs? What is the respiratory rate, rhythm, and depth? What's the chest wall movement? What are the breath sounds? Is there any use of accessory muscles? Does this sound familiar? Like a dream from last semester, right? Cardiovascular system. Heart rate and rhythm. Cardiovascular status, rather. Peripheral pulse amplitude and equality. Amplitude is sort of, you know, what's the pressure, what's the, you've got a little rating scale on your physical assessment sheet that is it a 1, 2, 3, 4, I think. And what's the equality? Always when you do something on one side, check the other side. Blood pressure and capillary filling. All of these I've put in here under cardiovascular status. Level of consciousness. Call the patient by name and note their response to that. Tell the patient surgery is over and they are in the PACU. The various levels that they might get back from this patient are that they're not responding at all, that they're arousable with verbal stimuli, that they're fully awake, that they're oriented to time, person, and place. What's the presence of protective reflexes, which indicates that the anesthesia effect in their body is ending? And the time for this varies, but those protective reflexes that I'm referring to are swallowing, gagging, and coughing, all of which have to do with airway. Swallowing, gagging, and coughing. What's the movement or the activity level? Are they able to move all four extremities? And this client is helped to turn, cough, and deep breathe that they've been taught so well by that preoperative nurse. This, of course, is provided that the vital signs are stable. Skin color, is it pink, pale, dusky, blotchy, cyanotic, jaundice? And when I say skin, I also say mucous membranes for persons of color. Fluid status, intake and output, and of course there's no PO intake now. But so we're looking at IVs and urine or wound drainage. What's the status of the IV infusions, the type of fluid, the rate, the amount in the container, the patency of the tubing? Again, review for you all those things you've learned. What are the signs of dehydration or signs of fluid overload? Again, back to NU175 when we talked about fluid volume deficit, fluid volume overload. What's the condition of the operative state? What's the status of the dressing? Is it dry and intact? And D and I stands for dry and intact, and that is a standard kind of notation on a dressing, and that is what you want. Now, it is not uncommon for dressings right in this very early post-anesthetic place to have some blood on them. Or it may be betadine. They look like it could be blood if you're across the room, but when you come closer, you can see that the betadine has more of a brownish kind of look to it. If there's blood on the outer part of the dressing, what you do is circle it with a pen. Put the time there and your initials so that if a half an hour from now or some later point in time it's expanding, you know that something is continuing to bleed.
You circle right on the dressing?
You're right on the dressing. That's when you have to do that. Because what you want to do is when you come back to assess a little bit later, has it gone beyond your circle? If so, something's still bleeding. I had a student find this once, probably more than once. But we were in evenings, and this patient had come back to the floor and had a lot of family in the room. And the student was in there doing her assessment of things. And she came back to me and she said, you know, they had circled it in PACU, but it was continuing to expand. So we put calls in, and they had to take this person back to surgery and recauterize or retie, whatever they would do. I can't even remember the type of surgery. But the little extra thing that I give real kudos to this student for was she was in the room and explaining to the patient what was going to happen and to the family. She noticed that the family had brought in some food. And the patient had some of the food. So we made sure that they knew that. They didn't like that too well, but because this person wasn't supposed to have anything yet, this person was still MPO. Okay. But they did, and because of the nature of the situation, they didn't want that food there at all. So when the person got, I think they came to the floor and put an NG down and attached it to and got it out of there. They did not want anything in that stomach. Maybe it was a risky situation. But anyway, just an example of nursing assessment and what she was able to pick up. First, the bleeding on the dressing, but then looking at the whole arena in there, noticing what was going on, and seeing food over here. Did you eat anything? And the answer was yes. Okay. Patency, character, and amount of drainage, if there's any wound drainage, from catheters, from drains, from other tubes. Discomfort, what's the discomfort? What's the pain level? Type, location, severity. Is there any nausea and vomiting, which would certainly be a discomforting kind of thing? Safety kinds of things. The necessity at this time in this PACU is for all side reels up. Call bell within reach. They may or may not be able to use it. If you have an opportunity, spend some time in the PACU. This is a wonderful, wonderful place for students to be because you will see nursing assessment at the top level. And these nurses who work in there are usually very seasoned nurses. That's the new word, however, for old. Did you know that? We have a very seasoned faculty here. Falling apart. I like that word. I bring it up. It's seasoned. These are seasoned nurses, usually. And they have literally got eyes in the back of their head. They are so good at their assessment skills. They can be anywhere in that room, and they are constantly assessing however many patients they're in there. And any little thing, they're going over just to check, to whatever. Every part of their bodies is assessing. They're really interesting to watch. They may not verbalize much because they're in this interior kind of room and they're focused on all these things. But if you can watch them for a little bit, and they glide, they almost glide. I've always thought that nurses in PACU should be on roller skates, depending on how big it is. Some of them are big, because they're constantly going, and they're like these little angels of mercy, you know, they're going around. And they just may gently just turn somebody over a little bit because somebody's gagging and the airway's coming out. And they just are constantly doing these things. So they're like magic motion nurses. They're really neat to watch. And they've got a lot of authority in there. And they've got a lot of standardized orders that they can do in emergencies because emergencies happen in there. Because these, again, are vulnerable patients that are now on the road back. And this is the first part of that journey. And they need a lot of watchfulness. So these nurses have acute assessment skills. Usually a patient is discharged from this PACU unit when they're conscious and oriented. When they're able to maintain a clear airway and breathe deeply and cough freely. That's a set of criteria for you, right? That's really important. They don't want them down on the floor if they're not able to do those things on their own. Their vital signs have been stable or consistent with their preoperative vital signs for about 30 minutes or so. Their protective reflexes are active, the gag, the swallowing, the cough. They're able to move all four extremities, unless one of them is in a cast or something like that. So you have to use your judgment there. Their intake and output is adequate. What is the amount of milliliters basic output of urine per hour? Bare minimum. Bare minimum. 30 milliliters per hour. They are afebrile, or the febrile condition has been attended to in some way. The dressing is dry and intact, and there is no overt drainage of any kind. Where are we at time-wise? Is this a time to break or not? It doesn't seem long enough to me. It's 10 to 10. Well, let's do it. Let's do it because I seem to be a little discombobulated here. So let's just do it. 10 minutes.